Hello and welcome to The Pantry Party. This is episode number 4 featuring Danielle Galvin.
We're your hosts, Bran and Liza. And yeah, we're so excited to bring you this episode. This is the second time we recorded this intro because we forgot to include a very important detail that kind of snuck into the last one, and you probably can hear the sound difference in it. Yeah, do you want
to... So, Danny and also future friend of the pod, Ashley Bennett, the body image therapist on Instagram, running a series of workshops in the States.
Mm-hmm. For the Body Reconnect Tour,
where they're doing a bit of, like, peer support, a bit of the, like, art therapy stuff. We'll link everything in the show notes, but it's, like, a really, really cool thing.
Concept.
And I am jealous that I'm not living in America and can't go.
Also, but yeah. You know, the In-N-Out burger and the Wendy's.
Oh, just everything. They're going to have so much fun. I'm so jealous. Mm. I've spoken to Ashley and Danny, like, both of them recently and been like, why did you not invite me? And they're like, sorry. But yeah, I'm super excited to see what comes of that. And if you're in America, which I'm sure, like, not many of our viewers are, but, like,
you are, go and
see them because it'll be well worth your time.
Yeah.
So yeah, because we forgot to put that in the first recording of this, we've re-recorded this intro, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, should we talk a little bit about this episode?
Yes, I think we rambled a lot about how great it was to go to Cairns last episode, so we'll just jump straight into what we talk about. One of the things that jumps out to me is that we talk about, diversity in dietetics, and whether that be body diversity or anything else. I think it's a very... taboo, I don't think is the right word, but it's just not talked about at all in dietetics, really, at all, having any sort of diversity. And I think Danny talks about how harmful that is, and how, I guess, lived experience comes into that and how we need to be better prepared to incorporate lived experience into our medical advice. Lots of touchy subjects, and I know that people can be quite opposed to it and have very strong opinions, but I think talking to Danny and talking about how it's harmed her is very, very compelling. Very compelling reason to include it into your medical practice.
Yeah, so I know it's sort of come up, especially in the health at every size community a lot recently, that we do need to have more representation of diverse bodies, especially in the health at every size space and in the body positive space as well. So I think this just kind of builds on that. Obviously this conversation was had months ago now, so it's not super up to date, but, I really recommend people do their research around this because it is so important at an individual level, but also at a population level. So hopefully we can sort of act as a bit of a starting point, a conversation starter for that.
Mm-hmm.
This episode's also really cool because we kind of go off the rails a little bit talking about some stuff around not raising children, but the way that kids react in dieting situations, talk about intergenerational trauma, a little bit about chronic illness and financial and otherwise support for creators and activists and that kind of thing. So yeah, I think we've got a really good chat here. We'll mention just quickly that when we were timestamping this episode, which we did months ago now as well, but I don't think we've ever laughed that hard. Oh my god,
so
it was so funny.
Danny's just great. I do think I was crying at one point. Probably.
Yeah, we were literally
like trying to hide it a little bit. Yeah. Just being like, I'm crying. This is hilarious. Yeah, apologies again if the sound kind of blows your ears off a little bit, but well worth it. We think it's a great conversation.
Yeah, it's really, really good. Also, there was quite a lot cut out of this episode, or this episode and the last one. You will have already noticed that there's two with Danny, just because we thought we'd make the most of our time up there with her and, I guess, have a bit of a lengthier conversation. If you do want to have an exclusive listen to some of the bits that we cut out, where we talk a little bit about... I think we talked about, like,
communities.
I'm not sure if we cut that bit out. There's a whole bit that we're going to pop up on Patreon about Indigenous representation in Australia. Obviously, none of us are Indigenous, but we all feel that it's a really important piece of the puzzle that's missing in our health system.
And I think we have very different experiences as well, because we've all come from different states.
Yeah.
So we talk a little bit about that, and how much it can vary within one country is very important. And yes, we do need to acknowledge that more than we do.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we have chatted about it a little bit in some other episodes, but that was an interesting topic of conversation. And there was also a whole heap of bloopers from this episode, which was actually what I was trying to remember.
Yeah, I was just reading the notes, and there are some really, really good bloopers, which I'm currently in the middle of putting together.
Like, look how long it is. So in our timestamps, we have like a little table, and the actual episode for both of these two episodes, the timestamp list takes up one page worth of table, and the bloopers takes up two whole pages. So it's kind of funny. Bran's cutting it all together into like a funny little compilation of us going, oh, wow, yum. So that'll also be up on our Patreon for anyone that wants to.
Just have a little lull, you know?
To be fair, I probably wouldn't pay for that content, so I totally get it if you don't want to, but.
But it's worth it.
Yeah, we're going to pop a few other bits and pieces up there as we go on. So if anyone would like to support the podcast, feel free to hit us up over there. Join our Facebook group, which is also through a paywall. So details of that is all on our website. That's so that we can support our community and everything. So. But if you really, really want this content and can't afford it, message us and we'll do something about it. But yeah, it was a super fun chat with Danny. So
yeah, I'm sad that the second episode's coming out, because we don't have much more to give you.
I know.
With her. Yeah. That's okay. Follow her on social. She's up to some very exciting things. And
yes.
She's done a lot of podcasts. So
She's all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. So go suss her out and see what's going on in her world.
Yeah, so let's jump right on into the chat. This is The Pantry Party featuring
Danny Galvin, part two.
Yeah, but I also think fat people are just not interested in going into dietitian or nutrition spaces because they've had such trauma-based experience in it.
Yeah.
So, like, what fat person out of high school is going to go, oh, I'm going to go into nutrition and dietetics? Because, like, even the people that I know now that are fat dietitians started off in smaller bodies and have gained weight. Mm. They didn't necessarily start it. I wouldn't be fucking interested in going in that space to be faced with all the people who are trying to change my body.
Mm.
You know, it's unappealing because the discourse and the information about it is negative towards their body.
Yeah. And it's hard, I think, like a lot of this stuff sort of unraveled to me post school, if that makes sense. Like it's something that I waded through education and through Instagram, the rise of social media.
Which is amazing because people that are disenfranchised or marginalised actually have a voice now.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is, a great thing in itself. But when it comes to, like you're saying, when you're choosing your degree at bloody 16 years old, which is a problem in itself.
Yeah, oh dude, who the fuck I was at 16? I don't want to be that bitch. She would have hated me and I would have fucking hated her.
But like, isn't it nice to see that growth?
Oh, hell yeah, it's great. Yeah, so, but like, you could not pay me enough money to be 16 again. Yeah. Like, you know when people are like, high school is the best years of my life. I'm like, cool, you are not my people. Because like, I could not wait to be 27 and not have to deal with this shit.
Yes.
But that's the thing, is that it's something you almost have to learn about later, because you have the brain capacity to unpack all this societal stuff.
Yeah.
But this is just observation, but I guess coming from a larger body into dietetics at 18, of course that's not something you want to do because you're going to feel like you're going to be, it's going to be a constant conflict.
Yeah, well, because at 18 you're probably still trying to lose weight.
Yeah, and so I was going to say, for me, like, I was always coming from a place, I love food. Like, food is what I want to do. Like, I think, like, my family's quite, like, my dad's a doctor and my mum works in the medical, worked in the medical community.
Because you're fancy.
I'm fancy. But coming from that position of, like, I want to do that kind of, medical side, and also food, dietetics was just, it just made sense to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was also very weight-centric when I started, and for me it was almost, maybe if I learn this, maybe I can learn how to control my own body.
Yeah.
And so I think
so I you're trying coming, to like, oh, I'll get the puzzle pieces to put it
together.
Yeah,
and I'll be, by the time I graduate, I'll be a size 10, and like, you know, and like that very quickly became apparent to me that that wasn't going to happen. But
isn't that interesting that that was like a motivation for
it was definitely a part of it. I was like, I'm going to do this so that I can control my own like control in inverted commas my own body. And it's just like, why was I set up to think that? Like, yeah. You know, if we can break down that.
Also, I think that if diet, like if what we would like dietetics to look like actually existed now as like a teaching course in education and higher education.
Yeah.
I don't think the majority of people who are in dietetics now would be in dietetics.
Yeah,
does that make sense? Yeah. Like, 100%. It would be a completely different cohort of people that would be interested in that because the people who are in there kind of reflect those values anyway.
Yeah, so, and I think a good comparison for that is people that choose to do social work because they quite often have gone through their own... Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, they quite often have gone through their own... like trauma or experience.
Well, and we're always attracted to things that, you know, make sense to us or kind of reaffirm our identity, right? So, yeah.
It's such an interesting thing because, like, I think the majority of dietetic students go into it wanting to A, be an expert and B, like, know all the secrets.
But also I think some of them do go in with an arrogance of being like, well, I eat well and I've lost weight and I've never had a weight problem, so I'll just use my experience to help other people. And then I wonder if they ever realise that, like, fat people kind of do the same thing. Mm. Like, Fiona Wheeler, when she did her presentation, she was saying, on average, when you look at societal impact of obesity, I hate using that word because it's fucked, but when you're looking at that from a medical perspective, like... most people in larger bodies eat on average 100 to 300 calories more a day than smaller body people. That's nothing.
Yes.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Yes.
And people think that they eat double the amount, you know?
Yeah,
and this idea that there's one fat body, what annoys me is, like, we see thin bodies as all individuals. Yeah. Everybody has a different thing. Everybody has a different interest. But fat bodies, you're all the same.
That's
you all sit on the couch at the same time. You all don't do this. Like, we're individual people. Like,
yeah, it's such a lie. Yeah. I think, yeah, it's really interesting talking about the impact of, yeah, I guess the obesity epidemic, in inverted commas again. It's just... like, we were taught about it. Like, I remember in my first year at uni, we had to write an essay on obesity.
I remember in grade 10 in health class being like, calculate your BMI.
Yeah. And it's like, so in grade 10. Damaging. Like...
and now there's this talk of weighing children in primary schools.
It gives me, like, actual anxiety. I literally, from having children, they're being homeschooled, like, fuck, I'm going to be that weird hippie mum that, like, they're not going to be able to integrate into society or have any friends, but they won't be fucked up, so that's kind of good.
Hey, maybe
actually, they probably still will be, let's be honest.
But, like, hey, maybe if they'll, like, regress. Do that,
yeah.
Like, they can
oh, remember we were at the retreat, it was funny, Louise was like, I wish I could just build a fence and, like, have us all live here and, like, invite all the fat people. And I was like, Louise, there's a very thin line between, like, community and cult.
Yeah.
Like, I love you guys, but, like, you know.
Right, this is a bit,
making a cult.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you can't just... Yeah. It's not really the way.
But I do think that as a society and as activists and people advocating for individuals, we do need to somehow have an impact on the way that we raise our children and the way that society treats children in terms of developing these concepts of weight. Because, like, I would have, like, had some kind of negative reflection on my body at, like, age 4.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
And it's, like, everyone would have.
Yes.
But where does that come from? Because, like, your parents aren't going to be like, oh, you're fat, you know?
No, like, but, like, it comes from... that's why when I was talking to you guys before about the interesting between female relationships, mother-daughter relationships really interest me.
I
just think they're really interesting about how that affects a daughter's raising. Not to say that men aren't important, that's a whole other subject, but, you know, whatever.
Well, from your experience, it's... Yeah,
yeah, like, the... I think so much of it is so ingrained, and children are like sponges. They pick up on so much that parents think, well, if I don't say to them, you're fat and ugly, they'll be fine. But the truth is that every little single choice you make, including how you treat yourself, affects your children and their identity and
how they treat themselves.
And I think our generation, well, my generation, I'm a bit older than y'all, but our generation's kind of had mothers who grew up in a very weight-centric time. And in a completely different time than ours.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping it'll filter out through the generations. Mm. But, you know, when I reflect on my relationship with my mum, and me and my mum are also in very different bodies, we look very, very different. So I wasn't a person that saw myself in my mum. I was like, oh, I want to be like my mum, and she's completely different than me, so how do I do that? It's really interesting to see how that stuff has affected her and how... she still tried to do the best with the tools that she was given, but how different that is to my experience now coming into a body positive space.
Yeah, and I completely agree because I'm quite similar. Have you met my mom?
No.
She's like...
Talk to her on the phone, though.
Very thin.
Yeah, like, my mom's like thin, yeah. Blonde, tall.
Yeah, and I think...
Oh, no, she has brown eyes, but like she looks like more
like
her
brother. Very different, yeah. But yeah. I can relate in that I've never looked like my mom. I don't at all. I look a lot more like my dad's family.
Same.
And so it's like...
It's always fun when you're compared to your dad at age, like, 13. Yeah. You're like, great, I look like a dude.
Yes.
But, like... What I ever wanted.
Yeah, and, like, that in itself is so complex. But, like, having that experience of... Obviously, you pick up so much of your parents' behaviour, and especially as a female, your mum's behaviour. Like, it's just so interesting that they aren't taught... Because who's going to teach them to, like, foster more positive behaviours and, like, model, like nothing against my mum, love you, I know you'll be listening, but, like, you know, a lot of her behaviour as I was very young would have led me down a very diet culture-oriented route. Mm. That's not her intention, but...
But it's also all they know.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that comes from, I mean, like, my mum was a little bit older than when she had me, so that she's probably, like, similar age to your mum, but, like...
Because I'm so old.
No, I just mean, like, that generation gap is kind of, like, merged, yeah. But, like, their parents would have gone through that kind of, like, war period, starvation.
Same. Well, like, my grandparents had my mum at 43. She was a change of life baby. They already had two kids at 18 and 16, that my grandma had gone through menopause. They were born in the 20s, so they went through the Second World War. They're Dutch heritage, so they lived in Holland during the Second World War. My grandfather's brother died in a war camp. So my mum is a direct result from a family that went through massive starvation through the Second World War. So it's interesting, even the studies that are coming out in regards to starvation of grandparents and how that's affecting further generations.
Yeah, in our first year, we watched a doco on that, and it blew my mind.
And how that affects weight.
The Dutch population. Yeah.
So as a generational, grandchild of Dutch immigrants who went through Second World War and is in a larger body, that's really interesting to me, that dynamic, and the research coming out about that. But, you know, for my mum, especially, like, you know, in terms of saving food and, you know, just food shortages, just how they look at food in a different aspect of than what haze is and even is, as more as fuel and something that you need to, you know, hold on to.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and I think that particularly for this generation that's coming out now, who are being born, I wonder how their parents, who are slightly older than me, their relationship with that either.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, like, I mean, obviously my experience is, like, so far from yours in terms of heritage, but, like, my upbringing was very, it was very apparent to me what was a good food and what was a bad food.
Of course, yeah.
And so it wasn't so much from a point of, like, resourcefulness for that, but it was like resourcefulness with your calories kind of thing. So it was like I was taught very clearly, this is a good thing, that's a bad thing, you can eat this, you can't eat that, and that is because if you do eat this, it's going to make you unhealthy, fat, whatever. And so it's interesting to see how, even though it's coming from a good place of I want the best for you, from your parents, that's so, like, damaging. And it takes a lot to kind of work through that and break down that trauma. Oh, the trauma,
yeah, dude. As someone who has had an eating disorder and had a mother from, like, the age of 5 who was trying to control my weight, because every time I went to the doctor, the doctor was like, your kid's fat, you need to do something about it. Yeah. And her being like, well, I don't want my kid to be fat because, you know, I'm getting told by a doctor, who's going to question a doctor? Yeah.
Also, like, being aware of the discrimination that fat people face in society. Obviously,
and also my parents are both smokers. Well, my mum has given up smoking recently. Yeah, go mum. But my mum and dad are both smokers, and they were both very busy parents growing up. They worked extremely hard, so food was fuel for them. Mm-hmm. Food was not about enjoyment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my mum still to this day is not someone that will go out to a dinner and really enjoy food. It's more like she's hungry, she will eat what she needs to eat, and then she'll get on with her day.
Yeah.
Whereas I enjoy food and love food, and me and Cameron love going to restaurants and trying new things, and she's not really interested in that. So if you're a child that's really interested in food and play and movement and taste and texture and smell, and your parents aren't, that's also really hard to modify, because you're like, oh, what's wrong with me? Why am I so attracted to eating this food, or why am I so attracted to, you know, eating chocolate or whatever it is? But my mum's very much someone who just eats
what she needs.
Eats for fuel, not for enjoyment.
Yeah.
So, it's a messed up world.
But I think, like,
on the positive side, we can have hope for the future generation, for like our kids and, you know,
fostering that kind of environment. I feel like our parents, I know my mum wouldn't have had this sort of space.
Exactly, yeah.
Introduced to it when she was like, I was a different situation because I was a fussy eater and eat the LCM bars.
Yeah. Oh my god, mum never let me buy them.
No, yes.
I was never allowed roll ups either. Oh my god, so many. I'm going to go to the shops this week and buy all the shit I wasn't allowed to eat as a kid.
I was that kid because I wouldn't eat like anything else. Like, mum was concerned that if she didn't give me that stuff, I would just starve the whole day. Like, oh my gosh. So bad. But I think if this space was around for parents to even just like dip their feet into so that they can trust themselves with raising their kid, I think it would change an entire generation.
Yeah.
And women have so much on their plates, especially as our generation of mothers, you know, we're fighting between equality and career. They had a different landscape in terms of the patriarchal environment for, you know, employment. There was a lot going on, and I think diet stuff can be really performative in a way to kind of bond with your daughter.
Yeah.
So, like, I see it now. Like, I always use the example which my friend or Imogen from Feeding of the Fox on Instagram has used before in her captions, which is, like, have you ever been to, like, a work colleague's birthday or, like, something employment-y, and there's a big cake, and then you hear the women go, oh, I couldn't eat hardly that smaller piece. It's, like, even if they're not on a diet, it's performative. It's like, look at me, I'm a good woman. I'm not eating too much. I'm not being gluttonous. I don't want to gain weight. I'm not indulging in bad foods. Or the diet starts tomorrow. I'm going to have to do an extra hour on the elliptical. It doesn't even come from a place of maybe when they go home, they have like a relatively normal lifestyle with food. But it's literally performative to be like, look at me, I'm a good girl.
Yeah. And also, just on that note, if you are having a tiny little piece of cake, are you enjoying that?
Yeah.
Like,
I just cut them all the same
just
size.
If you don't want to eat it, don't eat it.
Like,
eat as much as you want.
Intuitive eat what you... Yeah, I mean, unless you're, like, allergic to cake or something. Like,
also, I've found really interestingly... So I work in a physio clinic and there's quite... Like, birthdays will have cake and stuff. They're all health professionals. They know I'm a dietitian. They know I'm the expert in food and nutrition. And I will have that big fucking piece of cake and they'll be like, oh, like good on you. But also they're so jealous that I'm eating that because I'm enjoying my food.
Yeah.
And it's like...
this really bizarre concept.
Here's a, like well, you can enjoy that too.
We've demonized food groups so much so that people are so afraid to even have choice.
Yeah.
Like... the idea of a variety of diet is scary for them because that includes the bad stuff too. And it also means that less people are more, if you are in a place that you enjoy more hashtag inverted commas bad foods, then you're less likely also to try like the typical good foods because like you're afraid of those in a way. There's just so much connotation and like morality around food. Yeah.
And then the whole Instagram fitspo situation.
Clean eating, orthorexia, basically blinded by veganism. Exactly. Like, oh.
It's just thrown another spanner into the works because everyone's like, right, so in order to live this amazing, perfect life where I can go to beaches every second month, I need to be
eating. Who does that, by the way? I don't know one person.
Like, just not real
maybe
life.
Bella Hadid or one of those bitches.
Basically, yeah. It's like my whole population is that. But isn't that interesting that it's like those people, because they eat a certain or like portray themselves in a certain way, therefore have a body that allows them to do these things.
I was reading an article recently that I think you guys would find interesting that was like, so now that as a society we're kind of moving away from like Catholicism and religion as our main point of social connection, so a lot of people used to be religious, not only because obviously they believed in God and there was a quite heavy importance based on religion, but also because it was a real family and social connection for them and importance in their social circle. Now that we're moving away from that, it's really interesting to see the rise of morality around food and health choices.
What people pick up instead.
Because now instead of, oh, I'm a sinner, I'm going to go to hell for this, we've latched on ideas around food and exercise and weight that is like our new moral high ground to put on instead of religion.
And it's something that's, again, so multifaceted because I feel like it's come from doctors, public health messages, like, is that if you're healthy, you're doing good.
Yeah.
It's not this idea that health is a relationship and that it ebbs and flows.
Well, it's also,
like
this comes from this, this pagan idea, this Catholic idea of, like, westernized religion, that if misfortune happens to you, you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
So if you're sick or your child gets sick or something, it's God's punishment for something that you've done. You've sinned in some way.
Yeah.
So we have this inbuilt morality that comes from generational issues, even if your family wasn't very religious, but you grew up in a time that was much more importance around religion and God, that food and health, like you were saying, is like a basis of your morality.
Yes. Which it isn't, because everyone, like, I mean, obviously, but, like, everyone has their own relationship with their health and with food and their own health problems. And, but it's seen as, like, this good and bad foods, therefore, like, you can fix this by only eating good foods.
Well, I think that's why fat phobia still exists in such a pertinence, is because, you know, with race, people, obviously, there's still massive problems with racism and racist idiots, but a lot of people can still be like, well, they can't really change the colour of their skin. That's where they're born, right? But people think, well, fat people can just lose weight.
Yeah.
So if you're that unhappy and it sucks that bad, just try fucking harder.
Yeah.
There's this still idea that we can control our bodies. So in terms of fatness for discrimination, that's still seen as something that, like, is controllable. Whereas, like, race or disability or other things that happen to other people, cancer, those types of illnesses that people think are affect everyone. Fat people are like, well, it's your fault.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't know how we can address this, but it has to be done, because, like, why does some skinny girl get to enjoy her life and I don't? And to be fair, like, I don't experience as much marginalization as, like, super fat people, for example. But, like, why does she get to enjoy the same lifestyle, whereas I'm punished for it by society? Like, I don't get it. Like,
same education, same gender, like, eat as well, exercise as well.
Yeah.
Why does the way my body is genetically programmed?
Well, it's also the way that how fat men aren't usually told to lose weight in doctors' offices.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Yes.
That's a whole lot.
That's a problem.
You know, fat men are stocky and well bred, and he's just a big boy.
He doesn't have time to eat healthy.
Yeah, and also, you know, he's strong for his family. I'm like, yeah, he's a bit of a bigger boy, but that's just how he is. How come weight diversity and seen in men is like a men come in all different shapes and sizes. Women, you have this lead box.
But
congratulations.
It's interesting that
squeeze, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting that fat men are so underrepresented in body positivity on social media as well.
I think,
like, as a proportion.
Yeah,
like,
I think there are ways of doing it, but I also think men talking about things is hard.
Yes.
Talking about feelings, talking about trauma, talking about bodies is hard, because men are also supposed to not feel insecure about their bodies. And I think there is a big portion that probably just don't care because they don't face the same discrimination as women in those bodies. There's probably a big proportion that have actually found other things in their life that give them self-worth, because women are so fixated on their bodies.
So, told to be fixated.
Yeah, so men have less... I don't want to say less feelings, because I know that there's still a whole bunch of men out there that have insecurities around bodies, but their self-worth isn't built on one pillar.
Yeah.
Yes.
They have multiple pillars of personality that they get to evolve and adapt and things they're interested in.
Yeah.
Whereas women are like, how you look is most important, and then everything else comes under that.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You need to look a certain way before you achieve anything else.
Yeah.
I was having a... Are you on the Mindful Dietitian group? Either of you?
No, but I do know what it is.
So there was someone who posted who looks after a lot of veterans. And,
yes, I saw your comment on that. I was like, yes, Brad, comment
so
on that post.
I know a few people who are in the reserves now, and male specifically. But she mentioned that it's really interesting being a dietitian that works in that space, because body dysmorphia is a huge issue in that space, and it's the women who get preference or are picked up earlier. I think this is what she said, essentially, in terms of trying to dismantle that.
Mm-hmm.
The men don't exhibit symptoms of it.
Because they don't talk about it.
Yeah, and it's very much like, for them, it's just exercise. Like, it's not... I think what she was trying to say was that the women are seen as more of a vulnerable population, which we are, I think, in a lot of terms, just because of the societal pressures we are.
Mm.
But in that particular environment where all army-based training is around a lot of that strict regimen, it almost needs to be equivalent.
Yeah,
because
I think
she said that she's struggling treating a lot of these men because those ideals are so ingrained over however long they've been in the army or whatever it
is. And they don't realise that it's a problem.
Exactly.
Well, I think that's what people forget. People especially that are new to feminism, that as a woman, you're so focused on how the patriarchal system affects our experience, right?
Yeah.
But we forget how fucked it is for dudes too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't get to cry after the age of, like, six. Yeah. They don't get to show emotions. They don't get to create strong bonds with other men that are loving relationships like female friendships. Mm-hmm. They don't get to exhibit signs of weakness. That's why under 55, the biggest killer for men in Australia is suicide.
Exactly.
Because they don't talk about things.
Yeah.
So what is funny to me when men are so against changing patriarchal systems, it's like, you're suffering from this too, dude. Like, you know, you're suffering.
Yes, exactly.
But are they ever going to say that? Probably not. But yeah, there's a lot of
And I think
shit.
There are, like, I mean, I'm sure all of us have men in our lives that are, like, aware of that and aware that things, like, you know, there's a whole population of men that identify as feminists, and that's amazing and great, but
again, it's our lived experience thing, though. It's
but that's
really
why we need different perspectives, right? Like, I'm still learning from, especially in terms of disability and race, like, I'm freaking a baby in that, in those topics. I look to people online to discuss those things, because, like, I can talk till I'm blue in the face about my fat experience, but, like, am I a fat black queer woman living in, like, Detroit? No. Like, what does that look like for them? And, you know, it's interesting. I think more people that are live in the grey area in terms of life are more drawn to this movement in a positive way, because you see life in a more grey area. Unfortunately, not everybody does. And with a topic like this that is very grey, it takes a long time for the general population to get there.
Yeah, but hopefully, like, through, like, for people like you, through your work and through our work as health professionals, we can start to change that.
Mm.
Yeah. We can only be optimistic.
I know. I get stuck in the very, like, everything's on fire.
Yeah.
Fireplace a lot.
Just on that note, we were interested in your experience, kind of taking a step back and being a bit more reflective on yourself, of doing this work in such an isolated community.
Okay, on one hand, I love it because I get to just be me. Mm-hmm. I have a normal life. I have normal friends. Not that people in body positivity aren't normal, but, like, I have a very normal.
Yeah.
I use that in inverted commas.
Like, you're not surrounded by other influences.
Yeah.
Or, like,
That's what I'm more talking about. I'm not really part of that, like, digital bloggy, clicky thing.
Yeah.
Which isn't really me anyway. But just from traveling, part of the reason I live in Kansas is because, like, quality of life in terms of financial is so much better. I own my own house. I get to do my own thing. Everything's like it's amazing. Well, first you just got to stop eating avocado toast and then you get a house. No, don't get me wrong. I still have privilege in that space. There's still plenty of people my age that don't own homes all over Australia. Yeah. So living here has its twofold. One, I get to go to my life and be normal, drive everywhere 15 minutes. It's like a beautiful place to live.
So great. Yeah. Everywhere.
Look at that plant and that one. Oh my god, it's so green.
It's summer all year round.
I'm all like, everything is green.
Yeah, it's summer all year round. You can swim all the time. You don't have to think about seasonal weather. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Also, all my family lives here and all my partner's family live here. We both went to the same high school, have the same friends. So our immediate circle is here and I'm very much a family person. Mm-hmm. So that's important in my life. In terms of my work online, though, of being here, it is hard.
Yeah.
One, because the opportunities that I'm given aren't as easily available, and a lot of people assume that I'm American for some fucking reason. So I get a lot of brand opportunities or opportunities with my work that are really keen, and then they find out I live, like, literally on another planet, and they're like, well,
yeah,
you're like $1 billion to fly here, so no.
Yeah.
So that sucks. But what I have found for me personally, if we're reflecting on just my mental health, is that after traveling and, you know, doing meetups and, like, hanging out with different people, I don't think I could be someone that lived this in my real life in terms of associating with other people all day, every day, because it's really exhaustive work.
Yeah.
What I do online as an activist is super exhausting mentally, emotionally, and physically, and I need my step back. So instead of having my safe place be, like, oh, only my house, my safe place is, like, my in real life here. And I get to do as much or as little as I want, and I have more control over that.
Yeah.
I think the type of person I am, because I am a people pleaser and I'm super type A and I'm very achievement orientated, which I'm trying to change, but because I am more of a perfectionist, if I live somewhere like Melbourne or Sydney and there were more blogger influencer opportunities to me, I'd try and do everything.
Yes.
And I would get very focused into how many followers do I have and where am I going and how important, and I still sometimes feel that way because everybody does in this line of work. Not as much as some other people, I'm sure, but like you still feel inadequate all the time because we can always do better, right? That's the human race. But it's nice for me to have kind of like a safe home and a safe town.
Yeah.
But it does make it hard in terms of making connection and also feeling like people who get me and get what my morals and life and online stuff is about in real life is really hard. Because I only really have like my best friend and Cameron. And like, there's a few other people who I've met through Instagram here and I'm friends in the town, and that's great and amazing. But like, even when I do an event here, they're all people like fresh out of diet culture.
Yeah.
They're not where I'm at in my journey.
Yeah.
So it's hard. But by living here, I save money and then I get to travel more. So it's kind of like, well, you know, there's negatives and positives to everything. So.
Yeah. But we're going to ask how your local community has received your work.
Nobody knows who the fuck I am.
Which is like, I think nice. It's a good thing. Yeah, it's nice.
I mean, I had one chick one time when I was in Coles. I was like in my pajamas on a Sunday afternoon buying dog food, and she was like, "Your eggs Benedict look really yummy this morning." And you know when you don't know, you know when someone talks to you and you're supposed to know who they are, and you're like running through your bed, like, how, and I do a lot of different things in my job. My real life job involves a lot of different people. So there's a possibility I could have met her and just forgot.
Yeah.
So my brain's like running through like, who the hell is she? And she's like, also, like, because I follow you on Instagram. And I was like, oh, I put my breakfast on Instagram. And then she almost started crying, which was so nice because she was so like happy to meet me. But I'm not very good at responding to that. I'm not mean, but I don't know how to emotionally take it.
Yeah.
I get very like boundaried, and then some people love it. Like some of my other influencer friends who they meet people who are fans of them, or if that's what you want to call them, whatever, and get very emotional at them. They really enjoy it because they feel really connected to them.
Yeah.
I get like, who are you? I don't, at what, it's scary that people know so much about me and I don't even know their name.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it comes into that kind of dangerous territory of like, they do know so much about you and therefore make all these assumptions about you and also expect you to respond to them in a certain way.
I don't know. I my biggest fear ever is like someone really liking what I do online and making this idea of who I am and then meeting me and being let down by that idea because I'm human and just normal. And I think a lot of people are really nice about it, and I've had the greatest experiences ever in terms of in real life stuff. I've never had someone be rude to me that's known me offline, but it's weird. I didn't go into this being like, I'm going to be like Kim Kardashian famous. Yeah. Not that I am, but like I didn't go into it with that purpose.
Yes.
So that's really strange for me.
Yeah. Mm. And do you think if you lived in a bigger city, you'd have more of those interactions?
Yeah, and it would freak me the fuck out. I feel like I would, I could never be quote unquote famous. I don't think anybody, even if you're talking about Kardashians, I don't think anybody really goes out to like seeking the horribleness of being famous. Yeah. I don't think anybody wants that. It's just part and parcel of what comes with their career choice or what they do in their life. Yeah. But for me, feeling like I would always be watched would be really uncomfortable for me. Because I'm human and I make mistakes and I'm just like a normal person and I just want to be a normal person. I don't want to be Danny the Instagram person.
Yeah.
I'm just Danny who has an Instagram.
Yes.
So that's hard.
Yeah.
For me, and also managing people's expectations, because I am a people pleaser and because sometimes I can get very fixated on what other people think of me. I think that's a human thing, right? But I have in the past, sometimes after a big event or if I go travel somewhere and meet a whole bunch of other influencers, it feels really great in the moment, and then afterwards I get like a real slump because I'm like, oh, well, what if they don't like me now, or like just like so much interpretation of what other people think because of what they see online. It's not the full spectrum of who I am. It's as close as it can be, I think, because I try to be myself as much as I can, but it's not who I am when you meet me.
And it goes back to that, as much as you can try to be authentic on social media, again, it is curated. Yeah. You are choosing what you're putting up there. And not saying that it's inauthentic to you, but I understand what you mean.
You know what I mean?
It's like, that disconnect.
Yeah, and it's just, it's strange because there's people now who are coming into body positivity wanting to be a body positive influencer because it's an option.
Yeah.
And influencer is a thing now, and brand deals are a thing now. And even 6 years ago, Instagram wasn't what it was. Like, yeah, there was YouTubers, and yeah, there was, like, famous people online, but not in the way Instagram was, right? No. There wasn't Instagram influencers who were getting paid big bucks to do big brand deals. And people think, oh, this is a job career or a thing I can do as a hobby. I did not start my Instagram with that intention. Yeah.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because we are definitely, Brandon and I, part of a generation that does see that as a viable career option. Like for us, we kind of grew up with the growth of YouTube and stuff. Like, because you're a couple of years older than us.
Yeah, I'm like nearly 30. I'm 27 this year.
Yeah, we're 23, so it's like
there's still like a gap though.
My sister
turned 20.
Technology went so quick that between the older 20s and you guys that are younger, there is a generation of difference.
And between me and my younger siblings, there's again another gap.
Mm.
And so I think we've
They're probably like,
oh, it's mad, yeah. So it's
doing
like,
VR shit random.
Yeah.
But it's either like, flying spacecraft. Yeah. I don't know what young people do now.
But like, because we kind of came into our adulthood with that. With that Instagram thing, like there's friends of ours who are like successful on Instagram, but like it's not a career, but then they hold so much value in that success.
Yeah, it's weird, dude. And like moving into it as being something that's like, oh, I have this option now and I'm making money off it, and like I'm also an activist, and like there's gray areas, and is this a job and is this not a it's really confusing for me as a generation who like literally all we had was MSN and MySpace. Like,
oh, what a time.
It was the best. I wish we were still there, but like,
also so damaging.
Yeah. Like, but like,
signing not in the right MSN. Yeah. No crush, no.
Yeah, yeah. Changing your like little message to be like dramatic lyrics. Like, that was my thing. I had like, you know, you could like, you know, you could like HTML your like MySpace page to like look different. Yeah. I had like Hey There Delilah is like my intro song. Like, you know, just like daisies everywhere. I was like trying to be this bitch. I totally wasn't. But it's really weird for me.
Yeah.
It's really weird. And also strange now that I have people coming in my DMs like, how did you get this successful, and give me the like 10-point plan you did. And I was like, well, I woke up every day for 6 days and posted. That's what I did. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, have fun. And I think on the
I still don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, I am not an expert in social media. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think that I have more knowledge than I think I do, because I got to play and make mistakes and see what worked and see what didn't. So I do think I have social media expertise. Like, any brands that are out there, I'm not useless. But I still think that deep down I don't. There's a generation that grew up under me that values this differently than I do.
Yeah, and
I still find it really strange. And to them, it's like really cool and normal. Yeah, and I'm like, is it though?
Because of that, because people have that. You know, that influence that they've built with their social media and their following, it's also super scary because all of these really young people, girls especially, are coming out into this
thinking that that's what the life, what
the
life is,
and then
life.
Also like, having that influence and then selling skinny tea.
Yeah,
and it's like
it's kind of twofold. Like,
suppressant
life. So
it's, like, on one hand, I'm like, it scares me, like. Having children, my biggest fear is internet.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I think about having a child, my biggest fear is, when are they going to get a phone? When are they going to have access to the internet? How the fuck do I navigate that? It's like a full-time job within itself. Mm. But there is a part of me that's like, if I was 14 and had found myself on Instagram, how fucking different would my life be?
Amazing, right?
Mm. So I'm hoping that I can instill in my children the best ways to interact with the internet in a positive way, because it's a fucking amazing place. And I hate when people shit on it and be like, it's so damaging and everything's fucked and the world's on fire because of the internet. Well, no, because there's a lot of marginalized people who before were completely forgotten and erased from society because of mainstream media. Yes. And now they have community and now they have space. So it can be positive, but do I think 8-year-olds should be on Instagram like they are nowadays? Or like, yeah, it's weird.
Mm.
And it's weird for me. When I was 20, I started when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm 27 this year. So it's nearly been 7 years next year I've been online. Mm-hmm. When I was 21, it was like fun and different and like a completely different space.
Yeah.
It wasn't like people who have just joined Instagram or are younger don't even remember what that space looked like.
No,
it was like basic as hell. It was like, you know what web pages used to be like made by actual people?
Yeah.
You know, like,
this is like all photos of my feet at the beach.
Yeah. Or like, and with weird ass filters. Weird, like, way too dark. Why did we do so much contrasting? But like, at 21, it was just like a fun thing I was doing and I found community. And now at 27, moving into the phase of my life of thinking I have children and how is that going to affect it? And like, if I have children and then their friend's mum follows me on Instagram and I meet them at a school function, what does that look like?
And
like, how is this going to, because when I was 21, I didn't think about it like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And what worries me is there's people who are 12 who are posting things on the internet who don't even think of what that's going to affect them in 4 years' time or 4 months' time.
Exactly.
I mean, we were a generation that had the internet. We had Facebook, we had MySpace, we had the ability to send photos on our phone, but it was a different cultural aspect
still,
around
there was still very much like, don't meet strangers
on the
internet.
Honestly, it feels like prehistoric. Like, it actually feels prehistoric to what they have now. And what scares me is it's moving so quickly that in another 10 years when I'm 37 and I have a child,
like, who knows?
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think at least you're aware of that and you're aware of...
Yeah, I think I'm a lucky generation because we kind of got the ability to grow up before technology was a big thing and had a quote-unquote normal childhood. Mm-hmm. And then into technology came at a very slow pace that evolved quickly as we grew into our
20s. Yeah, yeah.
And then whereas my parents... think everything on Facebook is real, and every meme that's, when I show them a meme, they're like, who posted that? Or like, they show me some propaganda article, and I'm like, this is from some dinky ass website that was posted 4 years ago, and they're like, yeah, but it's news, and I'm like, meh, well, so I'm glad I'm not naive with the internet, I'm kind of really happy the generation I was, because I have enough brains about the internet and what it is, and I got to muck around with it a bit and make mistakes, but now it scares me.
We haven't really touched on the topic of chronic illness and having the capacity to create the work that you do, which I actually think is such an important topic, because like like, I probably need to get some shit sorted out with my mental health, but like, generally well,
don't we all though, don't we all,
like, generally healthy body, not having constant struggles with my health.
Yeah.
I struggle to have the capacity to create content online while balancing a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how the fuck I do.
Yeah, like, how do you manage to do that? Because you do have, you're very active online. You do have a very...
Am I? I feel like I'm getting...
Much more than a lot of other people.
Okay.
Like, more than me.
Okay, cool. That makes me feel good.
Yeah. But, like, having the... Just the capacity
energy and the motivation to do that. Because we've seen, like, interviews of people, like, puts a roof over my head sort of thing, and that's a big enough motivation. But when you add a chronic illness to that, sometimes it's sort of...
And then also getting such pushback from, like, diet communities.
Yeah.
And negative feedback in that space. Like, it just takes such a toll.
I'd love to have, like, a clear black and white answer for this, but it's kind of... evolving as my life evolves. I got diagnosed with PCOS at the start of last year, I believe, maybe end of the year before.
So that's official diagnosis is in.
Yeah,
like, it took a long
time. Yeah, so I've always had uterine blood period issues, but pretty much every doctor I went to, because I changed GP so much because of the fatphobic issues, and also just I kind of come from a very hardy stock of mother and father being like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get on with it kind of people. And my parents have never really had chronic illness and don't get sick, and my mum's the hardest working person I know, so I kind of grew up thinking like, oh, if you're sick or whatever, it's weakness. Also because of all the fat stuff and all the stuff I got told, like, oh, you're always tired because you're fat, or your periods are irregular because of your fat hormones, or you know, don't get type 2 diabetes and all of this other stuff. I pushed through. I think what helped me was I was young and I pushed through a lot of stuff I shouldn't have pushed through that I thought was hard for everyone, but maybe didn't realize how much extra hard it was for me. By the time I got diagnosed, it's because my symptoms had worsened. So PCOS symptoms, kind of like with any chronic illness, can flare or change throughout time. And it was getting to the point where the symptoms were really lining up and really obvious. So when I finally got diagnosed with that, part of it was relief because it was like, oh, all of this makes so much fucking sense in terms of all of my life and my experience. And part of it was like, okay, cool, so what do I have to do to fix it?
Yeah.
Not because I knew that I could fix it, because I can't, but because you're living in such an ableist world that's like, if you just do X, Y, Z, it'll fix it and you'll be fine. So I spent 6 months being like, oh, I'm going to really do this. And then a few things I tried didn't work. And then my symptoms changed again. And they continually have changed in the last year. Some days it's really hard. I can't do anything. My chronic, for me, a big part of it that is the hardest to deal with is chronic fatigue. Mm-hmm. So not really the pain, I can kind of push through that. Not really the bleeding all the time, even though that's really fucking annoying. And if I think about it too long, my head wants to explode. But the chronic fatigue in terms of tiredness is really hard, because then where do I find the energy if I can't even chill? Yeah. I'm lucky that I have a really supportive partner who's like super always in good health and like really picks up the slack around the house and like in terms of our general adult life responsibilities. But I'm also really lucky that I work for my family business. So in the times where I've had really bad chronic flare-ups, if I need days off,
there is a bit more empathy from you.
Yeah. And also like, I don't only have my sick pay and then that's it. Yeah. Like there's a lot of flexibility around work hours and time off that I would not get at any other employment, no matter how understanding they were, because there was times where I literally needed weeks off.
Yeah.
And that wasn't an that wouldn't have been an option anywhere else, especially because I'd taken so much annual leave going on holidays last year. So I think for me the biggest thing is, like, when I finally started to talk about my chronic illness, because it took a while for me to be comfortable to talk about it online, because when you're already feeling fragile and vulnerable, it's really hard to talk about online, because then when people are like, well, you should just try this, or if you did this, it would fix it. It can become really frustrating and make you really sad. So, but talking about it online has been kind of opened me up to a different community, because I didn't realize how many people in my community already had chronic illness. And also I'm kind of learning about what that means for me. If anything, it's kind of, if I want to be like super positive, it's kind of been a little bit of a blessing, because I have slowed down a lot. And I'm not a slow down kind of person, but it took that for me to get to that point, to have to slow down, to not have a choice. And Cameron, my partner, is kind of the opposite of me. He's like very introverted. He's very like take every day as it comes, like very just see how we go. I'm much more of a planner, and like if things don't go to plan, I kind of freak out a bit, and I have anxiety and he doesn't. So it's been kind of good, because him continually being like, you don't have any energy to do this, like you have to rest, has been nice, because I think if I was with someone who didn't really understand chronic illness, especially because mine's kind of invisible, and we're just like, well, you're fine, just get up and get on with it, that would be really difficult. But I have a really understanding support team. But it's hard. I mean, the hardest thing with me in terms of my content is I don't really fall into like a fashion influencer brand, in terms of there's a lot of plus size people who are doing fashion influence stuff. I like fashion, it's fun. But if you ask me to write about it day in, day out, I'd want to shoot my brains out, because it's just not something I'm interested in. That's not saying their work isn't amazing, because I follow heaps of fashion influencers that make me excited about fashion, but I don't get excited about it. And doing the work, like you said, with getting responses that are not always positive, even though they don't affect me, like when people say nasty shit about me on the internet, it doesn't affect me like I'm a bad person, I feel shit about myself, I wish they liked me. It's just like another microaggression that adds up, even though I don't feel that way about myself.
And having the energy to respond to that in a way that's actually going to benefit that person, because quite often they're not coming from a place of wanting to learn, they're coming from a place of hate, and they just want to attack you.
Yeah.
So I guess learning to fight your battles.
Yeah. That's kind of helped a lot. I think in general, I kind of thought, I think if you get stuck in thinking that your Instagram or your projects in terms of an online sphere is always going to be the same, is kind of stupid, because technology changes, things change, platforms change. One day Instagram won't exist, which is really scary to think about from an influencer perspective. But it's kind of like I've spent really like a last year in terms of every area of my life really working on like that ebb and flow of like understanding that a lot of shit's out of my control and I just have to do the best I can. And that kind of makes my overwhelm moments lessened, because it's like, well, that's normal.
Well, I mean, like, I think for me, viewing your work, like, it's, I'm not gonna use the word inspiring, because that's like a,
it's also really awkward, because I'm like
but like I think it, you do really well in presenting your chronic illness as like the harsh reality of it.
I think, like you said before, it's that so many chronic illnesses are glamorized, and like people obviously show the good days and be like, you can still live this great life.
Despite or like chronic illness.
But what about that gap where you are feeling shit?
Yeah.
what do you do then?
Yeah. Yeah. Or like the idea of influence of diet culture against chronic illness and how dietary stuff can help you. Like, don't get me wrong. Don't
get me started.
Brain's gonna explode. But don't get me wrong, like, eating a very nutritious diet that you feel good about and don't have guilt around and eating food that makes you feel happy will help you in your mindset and your life. But when I get people in my thing like, well, if you were just vegan.
Yeah.
Which is nothing against the ethical reasons like, behind veganism, but if you were just vegan, if you just ate celery, like, you'd be fine. I'm like, well, that's not going to fix my fucking uterus, so let's not go there. It's hard because I understand that each part of your life, sleep, stress, food, all impacts us, right? Mm-hmm. Exercise, that's non-negotiable. No matter how big or small you are, it affects your life. But to say that people, A, have the option to do that, B, have the energy to do that, and C, have the want to do that, or don't have trauma associated with food or exercise is really fucked up. Yeah. And chronic illness is hard enough without people telling you this will solve it. Also, it's coming from a very ableist view that once you get sick, there's an endpoint where you get better or you die.
Yes.
That's the two options, right?
Yeah.
Or what's really interesting to me is like, I have friends who maybe have different ability than me or in the disabled community that may have like an artificial leg or an artificial limb. They still have struggles and accessibility issues and a lot of stuff around their disability. But in terms of their energy and how they feel each day and when they get up and like what they can do and achieve and stuff, it's different than my chronic illness because some days I get up and I'm like on the couch. They're not on the couch for that. But general society sees people that have maybe are an amputee or use a wheelchair or different accessibility as like, oh my God, they're struggling so much and they're doing so well. But with someone like me who looks able-bodied, not that I consider myself part of the disability community, I just want to put that out there because I don't identify as that, but in terms of chronic illness, it's really hard to get across to people what your energy level is.
Yes.
Because I can go to work for 3 hours and do what I need to do and then come home and fucking crash, right?
Yeah.
But they don't see that part.
Yeah.
So that's why I try to show it on Instagram, because if I just showed the getting out of bed every day stuff, that's not real.
Yeah. And I think it's, like, super valuable to have, as a viewer, to have that shown because, I mean, like, we had this conversation with Tess the other day that Instagram is a highlight reel for everyone, no matter what that is. Mm-hmm. And so, like, obviously you're not going to want to show stuff when you're feeling like crap, but for you, like, having done that and added that, just that tiny bit of, like,
complexity
and perspective on that topic, like, everyone has times with it when they're feeling like shit and don't have the energy, even if it's not related to a chronic illness, like, at least you're speaking up about it.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really important.
I think that what can be hard is, like, I get a bit positivity policed sometimes. Mm. Like, why are you feeling so sorry for yourself? And if you just have a positive outcome, you'll feel better. And I do get a little bit stuck within, am I always talking about, because a lot of my work, I am talking about the shit realities of being a fat person. I am talking about the shit realities of having chronic illness. I am talking about the shit realities of being a human in this world. And it can be really negative and heavy and ugly and not black or white and really in a gray area and super individualized and super, like, I'm never going to tick all the boxes for every single person reading my post. But what's hard for me is when people kind of assume that because I'm talking about negative things, I'm a negative person, or I'm not trying hard enough.
But I think it's a large part of activism as a whole is seeing those realities, because I wouldn't understand any of that because I've never lived through it. So being able to hear that from someone who has that lived experience just educates me so much more and makes me want to be a part of that mission to make fat bodies more inclusive or whatever it is. I think it's, to me, it's been really valuable.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I think the only other thing, I think that the line can sometimes be crossed in terms of professionals using it as something to promote to seem inclusive is difficult because it can kind of turn into, like, a little bit inspirational porny. Like, you know, the idea that, like, if someone's has a disability or a different ability than you, that, like, they're so amazing for just getting out of bed. Well, you know, a lot of disabled people don't want to be seen that way. They're not amazing just because they decide to get out of bed or because they're in a wheelchair. They're amazing for all this other talented stuff that they do as a person, not because of their disability.
And having that perspective of, oh my God, they can do that, that's amazing, kind of when it's flipped is like, oh, if they have a day where they're not feeling up to it and don't have the capacity to do something, they're a failure.
Yeah.
When in reality, that's just their life. Like, yeah, they need to be able to...
Or it's kind of the idea of, like, making fat people in bikinis an inspiration that kind of pisses me off a little bit, because it's like, well, no, I'm not an inspiration for putting on a bikini. Yes, it is hard, and yes, it's difficult, and obviously I receive vitriol for it, but it's really hard to blur the areas of, like, making someone an inspiration just because of doing something that should end up being normalized, if that makes sense.
I guess so, it's that neutrality.
So it's just kind of like more examining your perspective of how you're interpreting the post and acknowledging your privileges and how that affects your view on that.
Yeah.
Because, like, I still have massive blind spots and I need to check myself all the time, but with body positivity, there's kind of like this, like, oh, she can do that, I wish I could do that. Well, instead of you being like, I wish I could do that, I wish my post was like, oh, she can do that, so can I.
Yeah.
Rather than,
yeah,
I wish I could.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting kind of area to be in, because there is so much, like, dependence on the way that the viewer is viewing your content.
Yeah, and also they affect your business.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, that's the other side of it, isn't it? It's like your pure income. Like, I was listening to a podcast with Kelly Thorpe on it, and, like, when it is your pure source of income, it can be terrifying having something that you can't change, your body, as the reason that you're getting money in.
Hell yeah.
And having people constantly berate that.
Yeah. It's really difficult, like, as a fat person, in terms of being on the internet and, like, just getting people to see that my activism is work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you know how much the biggest pushback I've ever had out of any brand thing I've ever done, which isn't very many, but any type of money thing that I've done, is my Patreon. People literally come into my DMs like, why the fuck would I pay you to do this?
It's like, well, you don't need to, but I need to support yourself somehow.
Or someone, so, like, this hate thread that I found the other day. Oh, which,
I read that on your stories.
Since then, they've commented on the thread saying, did you see how she commented on about us all on the stories? Danny, if you're reading this, I'm like, God, like, let it go. It's funny. But the biggest thing that they said was like, where was I going with my Patreon? The biggest thing they said with that was, like, she goes on holidays and she posts herself in these photos and stuff, and she works for a family business, so she doesn't need money. And I was like, you know, that can, like, coexist. Like, yes, I'm very privileged. I'm in a financial position that a lot of other people aren't. But, like, my work, I don't have a 9-to-5 in terms of this work. It's continual and constant. And, yeah, it's difficult. That's why sometimes I wish I was more professional in this sense, because people take that more seriously, and they'll pay people for their content. But even professionals, in terms of, like, even getting people to do lived experience content for them, are really hesitant in paying for their work. And I'm like, would I ask you to come do a lecture and you wouldn't ask to be paid? Like,
yes.
And I think it comes down to that perspective, is because, like, say, for example, if you and I went and did a talk together, and I was talking as a dietitian and you were talking as an activist, they can see that I've done a degree and I've had to pay for that degree to be qualified. However,
Lived experience is invaluable, apparently. Yeah,
but what they don't realise is you talking as an activist is coming from your place of trauma, which is a form of payment.
Yeah.
Like, that you've had to pay in the form of your...
Also, people see, like, money as, like... My therapist tries to get me to see money as, like, an energy transfer, because I really struggle with it.
I feel that.
So that, like, the energy that I'm putting in, people sometimes are transferring energy via money for me to do other things and to get more energy in different places.
Because if you did have more money to do this work, you wouldn't have to work so hard somewhere else just to support yourself.
I honestly, tomorrow, if someone could guarantee that I'd make, like, the wage I do, because I love my family business, I love working there, but it's not my passion. Mm-hmm. I am passionate about it, but I like what I do online work more, if I could guarantee it. But it's too risky. I have a mortgage. My partner's got a stable job, but, like, he's also casual, so that's, like, not guaranteed forever. Yeah. I don't have the ability. I am luckier than most people. I mean, my work life is really flexible. I only work 4 days a week. It's great. But, you know, to be seen as even worthy is really, it's really diminishing sometimes to be, like, and also you question yourself, because you're, like, am I just, like, someone who's, like, defrauding people of their money for nothing?
But then at the same time, like, back on the line of I've had to pay for my education, so therefore me sharing my information people should pay for.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't they pay for you educating them? Yeah. Like, you are doing so much work in educating and raising awareness about all these topics. Why, like...
I think because people come from a place of privilege and think academia is, like, the most intelligence you can be. So, like, a lot of people don't put a lot of value on lived experience because it's a lot more work around empathy and emotional stuff, and people don't value that. That's honestly where it comes from. People just don't value it. And that's not to say people don't, because I have a lot of patrons who really support me, and, like, heaps of people who do. And I've got really great opportunities coming up. But it's just harder to fight for. Like, I honestly, tomorrow, if I decided, okay, I am Jenny Adriana, is now going to be, like, a weight loss blog, and I'm going to flog weight loss shit and do fitness collabs and do skinny tea the amount of fucking 58 times that they've emailed me and I've told them to fuck off. If I did that, the amount of money I would have. And people literally would look at that and be like, she's not doing anything wrong. She deserves that. And yet the work I do, people literally start threads on the internet to tell me how fucking worthless my job is and how I don't deserve money. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's just the values that we have in society. And I don't align with the value that most people have.
And I think...
Which is fucked anyway. It's, yeah, it's because, nuts. Like, I think about the fact that the Kardashians, for example, have so much money and yet they want to promote a skinny tea or an appetite suppressant lollipop and everybody thinks that's okay. Like, how can something that's actually going to benefit society not be seen as being educational or worthwhile paying for, but people will happily binge watch the Kardashians?
I mean, I would love to get a place where we could coexist. Where the Kardashians could make their coin and do what they want to do. I mean, hopefully not with appetite suppressants, but, like, just be themselves and do their reality stuff and me also coexist and be valuable. But... it's just not the case. I mean, I could turn into a fashion blogger tomorrow and make 10 times more money than I do now, but it doesn't make my heart happy.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you need to balance that passion and business sense, I guess. There's no point doing something if you're not going to be satisfied doing it.
Do you think that it's a failure on society's part to see your work as work?
Because as not as work, do you mean?
Like, no, as in, do you think people are... failing to see the work that you do in this space as work and therefore don't feel they need to pay you for
Hell yeah.
Because, like...
literally, people think that I wake up, take a photo and write an Instagram question. They think that's my job. They have, like, no idea what actually goes into my business.
And I think the other thing is, even putting up that Instagram post and writing a caption... writing captions for Instagram is so hard and takes so much time. And if you're going to write a long caption that's actually going to portray... what you're trying to say and, like, get the message across, that takes a lot of your time and mental capacity and energy. Like, why can't people recognize that?
People think it is.
I think people glamorize Instagram because a lot of social media influencers who are diet culture skewed and are thin and are pretty and are making big bunks off campaigns and brands that want to support them because they fit their social ideal. It seems really glamorous. You travel everywhere, you do all this fun stuff, blah, blah. I'm sure people think that I'm, like, living the high life. And, like, I love my life. I have a great life. But, like, money it's would not, help. You know, especially with getting stuff off the ground. Like, my audience has been barraging me for, like, a year and a half, 2 years to write a book. And I'm like, I do not have the time or emotional effort or, like, ability to approach publishers, let alone try to finance it myself. I've seen my friends write books and I know how fucked it is and how hard it is and how much time it is. And yet people think that I honestly think people think I'm just getting, like, brand deal opportunities every day. I work hard at what I do. But... yeah, people don't see it as work. I mean, some people do. A lot of people support me and do really great stuff, but the majority of people think that, yeah, I just wake up and put a cute outfit on and post a photo and then expect people to pay me money for that. Which, to be fair, as someone in a fat body who you're seeing my body and, like, profiting off, whether that be inspirationally or whatever, like, you owe me too.
Like, exactly, And, like,
if models get money for taking their photos.
Like, exactly,
Not that I'm a model, but, like, you know what I mean? It's like, how is that seen as a valid job and yet my job, even if I did just post photos and put cute captions, like,
how is that not the same?
I think...
If you're following me, in my opinion, apart from these fucking hate followers, whoever the fuck they are, if you're following me, then I add value to your life,
So why wouldn't you... And, like...
you pay for Netflix subscription.
For me,
I, like, really honestly wish Instagram had, like, a subscription.
I agree.
But also, that gets really messy because then it's like, who do they value more? And also, Instagram is a bit of a cunt.
And on that, Beep that out. On that vein, like, do you think it's because the majority of the people that are benefiting from your work? This is a really leading question. I'm trying to think of a way to rephrase it. Just from like having considered this and analysed this situation, one hypothesis is that the people who are benefiting from your work are less privileged, both in terms of marginalisation, whether they be coming from a chronic illness background or from a fat, like higher weight background. But then also, quite often that will put them at a societal disadvantage in terms of financially not being able to support.
Yeah, so you're saying, like, my audience is already marginalised, so it's hard for them to find.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. I think the biggest part of my audience are students.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like...
like, they don't have money. The amount of people that message me, like, I love you so much and I wish I had $2, but... and I'm like, I do not want anybody to financially support me to put in financial ruin.
Yeah.
I wish that Nike tomorrow would call me and be like, we're just going to feature fat people for the next year because we've featured, like, thin people for a year. That'd be great.
Yeah.
But big brands don't want to work with me. And also because a lot of people who are fashion, as in plus-size fashion, go into it as a business from the start... they curate their feeds to make it brand friendly, and I don't.
Yeah.
And I'm not flexible in changing my morals.
Yeah.
Brands don't want outspoken, loud, fat activists as the face of their brand. Yeah. Some do, but a lot of them are like, it's too controversial.
But also, you're not here to sell people shit.
Yeah.
Which is like where the whole brand relationship fails, because you're not trying to... like make someone buy something in your content. Like, that's not the purpose of your account.
But it's funny because, like, you know how you said, like, a lot of people, like your generation or whatever, see that as like a career thing, as normal.
Mm.
I get less pushback on when I do brand stuff, and yet still nobody supports that brand, so then the brand gets disappointed with my output.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like,
you can't guarantee.
It's so hard. And it's also like the things that I want to do that I know would create more money, so like doing a fat activist course on Teachable or something like that.
Mm.
I don't have the money to fund that right now, nor
exactly.
do I have the emotional capacity to do it, plus do my daily output of content.
Mm-hmm.
But people think my daily output of content is not enough to be paid for.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. Which is just...
but also, on the second hand, like you just said, there's a big part of my audience who cannot societally or financially afford to support me.
Yeah.
And that sucks because they're... the people, like, you know, how many fucking white bro dudes have a podcast that has a Patreon, like, of, like, 30
streamers
grand
on,
fucking...
like, okay, gamers?
Yeah. Not that that's bad.
No.
My partner watches it, too.
Yeah.
But that's value.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because, like, Harrison, my boyfriend's, like, super into gaming as well, and he'll watch people streaming their stuff on Twitch, and they'll be, like, every time someone subscribes and they've paid money, they'll celebrate that. And it's, like, these people are... first of all, in a financial position where they can afford to buy those games or have been gifted those games, and like
biggest audience are also other privileged people.
Yeah.
So privileged white dudes selling stuff online of their hobbies or whatever to other privileged white dudes who have the money to finance that.
But also they're barely
privileged
selling
white dudes
something
don't give a fuck
because
about
it's,
my
it's
account.
In the same vein that your work is not work in inverted commas. Their work is literally playing a game online, which is for most people leisure.
Oh, yeah, in my head, I'm like, how is that a job?
So it's
like...
but also me, because I'm not in the gaming scene at all.
That's the thing.
It doesn't make sense to me,
because
it's not a hobby I'm interested in.
But how, I mean, if that is to be compared to your work, how are they so much more successful than you when you're actually putting in so much more energy and time and, like...
Yeah, it's frustrating, because you constantly... what I don't think people understand is my work constantly butts up every day against the fact that I'm not a thin white woman that's palatable and easy to sell and, like, doing skinny teas on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I will never be her.
Exactly.
Even if I wanted to be, and I don't want to be.
Yeah.
But in the fact of me taking a stance that I don't want to be, and the fact that I don't want to be palatable, and the fact that I don't want to change myself to fit something and be an influencer, in quotation marks, I suffer for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think...
and then people are still not happy.
Exactly, yeah.
That
but
I
think, I mean, as we've been talking about all day, the society around the internet and social media is growing so much. I'm really hoping that somehow we can get to a place where that system can support you.
Yeah.
Because there'd be so many people like you and other activists in their own right, whether it be for disability or for chronic illness or racism, like anything... them being able to do that work is going to make our society such a better place as a whole.
Yeah.
So
I think what we were saying before, like going back to lived experience in terms of how professionals can help, I'd probably just like put a shout out to the pod. If anyone's listening who is a professional, who's in a privileged body, like start paying people that you follow on Instagram that you get lived experience from that help your practice.
Yeah.
Because like you're gaining from them to help in your work And if you're not paying them...
Yeah, and like you're getting paid to do your work from the clients, so therefore that money should be going towards...
Pay your rent, get your shit done. But like if you have extra and you have the ability to do so, it's important to give that back to the community.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially as women, I think we all need to like financially help each other up on that level because like it's not happening.
Yeah, I totally feel that.
Final question.
Is this what food would you be if you were?
No.
They made us ask. They made us ask that at the retreat, and everyone was like, "I'm pumpkin pie," or like whatever. And I was like, "I'm chicken." And they were like, "Why?" And I was like, "Cause that's my nickname from Cameron." And also, when I see myself, I'm like a fat mother hen, like waddling.
Yeah.
And also, I love chicken, but
chicken's great.
Yeah. No, that isn't the question. But thank you for answering. You're welcome.
Valuable information. That was
that's gonna have to be in like the Fast Five in like season 2.
Yeah.
What food would you be? It's interesting. Because Louise, our she's a psychologist, I'm like, you're just fucking analyzing.
Yeah. I'm not. You're doing this for your personal
gain. I'm not gonna give you what you want.
Pay me for my
experience. Yeah.
Thanks. Now the question is, what does food mean to you?
Oh, food means to me mainly like memories. Or, like, warmth. I think I've worked a really long time and a really hard way to make food mean something that's, like, valuable to me rather than something to be, like, I wish I just didn't have to eat, which is how I used to feel. So, yeah, like, memories. Like, my favourite food, like, that makes me feel good is always, like, contributed to, like, a memory with someone or, like, going to a nice restaurant and we had a good experience.
Mm.
It's kind of, like, the whole thing rather than just... what it is to eat.
Yeah.
And that's like what we've tried to capture with the podcast, that food is, well, not obviously not the main purpose of the podcast, but like food is so much more than just food and nutrition, and it is about the society, like the value.
It's cultural.
That, yeah, it's a culture.
It's a whole
thing.
It's experience.
Bonding.
Yes.
It's like smells and memories and people.
Yeah.
Are there any particular meals or foods that you associate with a certain... event?
Baking always makes me happy because I'm not a cook. Like, I, in terms of, like, making food for dinner or something, like, Cameron is much more of the chef in our house. I don't really enjoy cooking, but I enjoy baking because it's, like, fun and you can make it pretty and it tastes good. And it's, like, usually for, like, a birthday or a celebration or something. So I like to bake, but, like, anything, like, carby or, like, cheesy or, like, Italian-y or...
So cheesy garlic bread, really.
Yeah, or like, you know, like pasta, like I really like heavy, warm dishes.
Yeah.
Or like seafood has a big like thing for me because like we always eat prawns at Christmas and like I live in a very like seafood orientated place in the world. Like we have really great fresh seafood. So those things make me happy. But like I'm always exploring new things. Like I think that's the fun part about having a partner who really also enjoys food. Because we go out to places and, like, when we've gone travelling, we really, like, want to try foods and, like, destinations and stuff. Not that we're foodies in, like, a pretentious way, but, like...
Melbourne way.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't... You said it for me. But, like, I like experiencing different foods.
Yeah.
Yes.
And my favourite food shows are, like, not, like, MasterChef or whatever, but, like, my favourite food shows are, like, travel food shows, which show, like, where the cultural history... comes from and why they cook that way and what it means to them.
Have you watched Ugly Delicious on Netflix?
No, not yet.
Oh my god, get onto it, you'll love it. It's all about like comfort food. But also,
have you seen Somebody Feed Phil?
No, I haven't.
So good.
Okay, I'll watch that. You watch Ugly Delicious. It's oh my god, so good.
I need to watch both.
Yeah, somebody
friends list for like
somebody
TV is like
watch Flat Earth Last. Somebody Feed Phil is the best. So the guy on it named Phil, he's the guy that they based Everybody Loves Raymond off.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like the actual real life Raymond, and his parents are like his real life parents. And he's like Jewish, and he like travels around, and it's kind of like a travel and food show, but like he loves food.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just
nice.
I don't know. The Portugal, the Lisbon episode in Portugal is like why I want to go honeymoon there, because it's just
I'll have to get onto it. And that and salt, fat, acetate.
Yeah, I haven't watched that yet, but I've heard a lot of people like that.
Amazing. And I think what's nice about all of these shows is they're not coming, like, I think a lot of cooking shows, like, traditional Australian, like, when you turn on the TV when you're homesick from school and it'd be, like, Ready, Steady, Cook.
Hey, don't even fuck on that show. No, I've been like through a lot of 3:30 p.m. Yeah. Okay? I was always our Red Caps again. Yeah.
But, like, a lot of
also,
the...
watching people who can't cook is funny.
Yeah, hilarious. But I think a lot of the, like... There was a very potential time where it could have strayed really badly down the diet culture route, but now they've kind of
like gone into more of a Biggest Loser kind of way.
Yeah, and so I think it's really nice that all these Netflix shows are like, food is amazing, and it's it is a cultural thing, and it brings people together, and here's how we're going to talk about it. And I just, it's so nice.
Well, I think that's the funniest thing when you actually meet like chefs, is like, the way they view food is the way we all should view food.
Yeah.
It's like,
they see it as like a piece of art. It's incredible hearing a chef talk.
And like
about
the texture and the taste and like the different flavors and how they interact together. It's like a language.
Yeah.
And like, even though I'm not a foodie, so I like don't know the language, I like to pretend I get to try the language.
And you can still get that experience without having that education to know the language.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's such a unifying thing.
And it's just, it just makes you feel good. Like, food should make you feel good, regardless of what you're eating. It should make you feel happy.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it won't. Sometimes food is just fuel. Sometimes you just have to get through the day. But
on the whole.
Yeah, I wish people could love food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good note to end on.
Yeah.
Yay. Thank you for letting us come to Cairns on a holiday.
Yeah, enabling our holiday.
Pretty amazing. Can we eat some fruit?
I'm
not starving. Talking
about
let's
just wrap
food.
This up. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye.
The party's over.
Thanks for sticking around, though. And thank you so much for coming to our pantry party.
Yeah, I hope you had a great time. I mean, we sure did.
Oh, no, don't worry about doing the dishes. Leave them there.
Yeah, we'll clean it up tomorrow. Just get home safe.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, if you really want to do something, you can hit the link down below that takes you to our Patreon page.
Or, you know, just check out our website or Instagram. Share this episode, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Maybe we'll be new and noteworthy one day.
That'd be a great review for a party.
Yeah. But either way, go home. The episode's over.
Bye.